On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
It appears that Iraq's air defenses are on a pair trigger here, if you will, at this time.
The government has decided to commit Australian forces to action to disarm Iraq because we believe it is right.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction.
These were obviously multiple rocket launchers being used, and this has been the first sustained onslaught, and I think this marks the opening of what had been...
The window is always open for diplomacy. It is closed only for those despots, for warmongers, for war traders, for evil mongers in Washington.
Twenty years ago, millions of people around the world took part in the biggest anti-war marches in human history. They sought and failed to stop the invasion of Iraq. But the leaders weren't listening, and so on the 19th and 20th of March, it happened. At the time, Bush, Blair and Howard told the world that our aim, the so-called Coalition of the Willing, was to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to end Saddam's support for terrorism, and to, quote, free the Iraqi people. I vividly recall Hans Blix saying to me on this very program that there wasn't a hint of evidence that Iraq had WMDs, and as for the freedom of Iraqi people, the invasion began a series of events that led to civil war, widespread corruption, the rise of jihadist groups like ISIS and political instability that continues to this day. The death toll is still disputed, but it was immense. Raith Abdulahad grew up in Baghdad and trained as an architect, but he became a translator and then a journalist after the 2003 invasion. He's gone on to win oodles of awards for his reporting from Iraq and across the Middle East, including the British Press Awards Foreign Reporter of the Year and two News and Documentary Emmy Awards. His book is titled Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East's Long War, and it is, quite simply, superb. Raith joins us now from Istanbul, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the program. The book has been a labour of love. You've been working on it for almost a decade. What did you hope to make us realise about Iraq and its people?
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be on your program. Well, I mean, when I didn't start writing a book, it's just kind of the history. It's just the history that was unfolding literally down my street. So at the beginning, I was just, you know, literally just walking around these American tanks and trying to see what's going to happen. You witness the statue falling. But then ultimately what happens is when you see your city divided, the community suddenly split over a sectarian line and a civil war rages in your city. That is the moment when you realize that actually history is unfolding right in front of your eyes. And of course, it wasn't one civil war, but one civil war led to another civil war, and then ISIS happened. So 20 years later, when I wrote the book, I kind of simply decided to tell the story of the events that unfolded in my city, through my people, and through the people who were just kind of not only witnessing these atrocities, but also the people who committed these atrocities.
The book is well titled Stranger in Your Own City, and we'll talk about it later. But tell us a bit about your childhood. What was it like to grow up in Baghdad under the dictatorship of Saddam?
Well, I have to confess, it was a very, very boring childhood. I mean, minus the wars, the Iran-Iraq war, the 1991 war. Personally, I lived a very boring childhood. None of my family was persecuted, killed by the regime, nor none of us kind of joined the regime. So it was as boring as it could be. However, I mean, the rest of the world kind of strive to make it more exciting. So I remember kind of at the age of five witnessing the first air raids on Baghdad by during the Iran-Iraq War. 91, of course, that was the real destruction of the city during the first Gulf War. And of course, the sanctions that followed. So the regime for us was, I mean, for me personally, in my childhood, Saddam was like a god, you know, probably more important than God himself. And he kind of dominated every aspect of your life. His pictures were on the TV, in your school books, in the classroom. You couldn't mention him, but it always... You don't mention his name, but you always talk about him. So that's how he dominated our lives. He dominated our life with his long, boring speeches that just basically drove everyone nuts. And of course, he dominated our lives by you know, his party militias, the obnoxious party members, and wasting three decades of Iraqi history and Iraqi lives.
Right, at the time, the outside world saw sanctions as being, in a sense, as brutal as any war. And they were right in terms of what was going on in your country.
I mean, personally, I think the sanctions were more brutal than the war. Because the war, you see the bombs falling, you can run away, you can hide, you can do whatever you want to do. But in the sanction, it just destroyed the middle classes. It just crushed the people, deprived them out of dignity, and it established the corruption that we're living through today. When the teacher's salary becomes $2 or $3, when a policeman gets like $3 or $4, the only way to survive is through corruption. And that's what the sanctions did. It drove tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands probably of Iraqis outside the country to work as everything from taxi drivers to laborer outside in Amman and Beirut and other places. And the sense of a country was destroyed, and we were just besieged there. Another factor with the sanctions, it basically strengthened Saddam in his small circle, because he became the only source of power, of resources, of money. Whatever money that Iraq could get during the sanctions, it came through the regime. So in a way, it lengthened the life of the regime.
I remember on the program talking about the UNICEF figures, 500,000 children dying because of the sanctions. But of course, as you point out, religiosity spread throughout this period.
Because when it's time of poverty, when it's time of need, who do you seek solace from? But the mosque, the church, whatever. And that is, see, Saddam's narrative in the 80s and the 70s was about pan-Arabism, nationalism, socialism of some sort. In the 90s, it became about religion and the tribe. He became the commander of the faithful. He became, you know, his titles changed to more religious titles. And also, he kind of positioned himself to be kind of the tribal elder of all Iraqis. And again, so he used the language of religion to extend his influence and to counter the influence of other religious movements that were spreading through the Middle East.
Many of your friends left. You couldn't. Why was that?
Well, because I was a military deserter. I was studying architecture. Then I was handed my conscription papers. I went to the camp. I saw the way people were being treated, the young conscripts. So I deserted. And for 5 years, I was living as a deserter in Baghdad. I didn't survive because I was brilliant, but because the regime was weakened because of the sanctions. I tried to smuggle myself out of Iraq, like many others did and still doing, but I failed. I didn't have the resources, so I was stuck in Baghdad until the moment the Americans entered the city.
I can remember vividly what those months were like leading up to the invasion in 2003 when Bush was trying to invent a case for invasion. But what was it like in Baghdad at the time?
You know, I mean, we kind of, at one point, we were convinced that the war will happen, but I don't think any one of us could believe that the regime would be toppled so quickly. I thought, you know, the war will happen, they will take part of the south, create a no-fly zone like they have in the north, and it will be, you know, a long war. But to see this regime that has built so much security forces, so much security apparatus, collapsing within a couple of weeks so quickly.
Of course, Wraith, we've witnessed that again and again in recent history, haven't we? When apparently implacably strong structures just fall apart.
Of course, you know, it fell apart because no one wanted Saddam. I mean, none of his generals, none of his officers, none of his, even his people and security services wanted Saddam anymore because they realized he was a mad dictator. He was just driving the people, you know, from one war to another war. But that doesn't mean that they wanted to see what happened after the war.
You make the point that Iraqis were being presented with the choice between a foreign invasion and a noxious regime. Did they have a collective view?
I mean, the collective view, which emerged during these demonstrations that took place in 2019 by the youth in Baghdad, and the one common chant was, you know, we curse Iran and we curse America, because in a way, we were again put in this binary choice. This time, Iran and America. Then it was Saddam or the occupation. As if the people have no other choice but a mad dictator or an illegal occupation. I mean, people deserve something else. We don't need... Saddam was a dictator. He was evil. He occupied, you know, the lives of his own people. But that doesn't justificate an illegal occupation and the civil war that emerged after that.
Mission accomplished. The invasion comes in March, and by April, Baghdad was captured. What was it like when the Americans arrived? Did it feel like a liberation, or was that simply a facade?
An absolute facade. You know, there was a moment of freedom, which, you know, on the 8th of April, kind of suddenly something happened and all the security forces vanished from the streets of Baghdad. I woke up in the morning and I couldn't see a single policeman. At that point, we had militiamen, you know, party militiamen standing at every street corner, armored trucks and whatnot. And then 9th of April in the morning, there is nothing. And then within 1 hour, the Americans arrived. So that was the moment of freedom, probably hung there between the dictator and the foreign armies.
There's a bit of powerful symbolism where the people are trying to topple that statue of Saddam, but the Americans sort of take over and raise their own flag.
You know, I was standing there and I saw that American soldier pull his flag. And at the time, I was thinking, oh, my God, what are you doing? I mean, it's like the imagery, the theatrics of it is so wrong. I mean, you know, every camera would capture that scene. But to be honest with you now, 20 years later, I think that soldier, that Marine actually, was more honest than all the politicians. He knew the war was a war of between his people, between his army and Iraq. It was not a war of liberation. It was not a war to free Iraqis or weapons of mass destruction. So he saw it as a conflict between two armies, and he won, and he put his own flag. He was, I think, in his, you know, crude way, more honest than Bush and everyone else.
My guest is Wraith Abdulahad, and we're talking about what happened 20 years ago with the invasion of Iraq. Tell us the story of how you became an interpreter, because it was a twist of fate.
So the day after the statue fell, and I don't know what got into my head, and I wanted to walk into Saddam's palace. Why? I don't know. I thought if I walk into the corridors, I would learn something about our history. I would know why we fought Iran, why we invaded Kuwait. I walked through American checkpoints. I had a backpack and a kind of an imitation of a British accent. And for the Americans, any weird accent must be British. And I kind of, they let me pass through when I reached the gates of the palace. I mean, I can't imagine how weird the scene is. It's just this foreign army standing at the gates of the palace of Saddam, a place you couldn't stop to look at. I walked into the palace. I saw the first corpse in my life. I saw a puddle of blood. And then there was the palace with the Saddam bust over it and American soldiers. And I was given a tour of the palace. I wanted to continue walking because it's kind of like it was surrounded by the river from two sides. I wanted to cross another bridge. I was told you can go. So I had to walk back and I was tired at that time. I saw this red SUV coming. I waved, you know, the journalist inside lowered the window. Who are you? I said, I'm a British journalist. I said, oh, really? We are also British journalists. So that was the day when, and they were working with The Guardian. They were, you know, James Meek, a brilliant Guardian journalist. And I ended up working as his translator.
You were told to ask people whether they were Sunni or Shia, but which struck you as both crass and unusual. Just explain why it was so strange to ask people this binary question.
See, Iraq, although Sunnis and Shia are part of Iraqi history, it is a cultural, religious definition at the eve of the war in 2003. It was not a political definition. So all Iraqis, Sunnis and Shia, suffered from the sanctions. All Iraqis, Sunnis and Shia, were conscripted to go to the war. That binary idea, pushed by politicians in exile, Iraqi politicians in exile, trying to create or recreate this, you know, Hutu Tutsi binary, the kind of Muslims and Serbs binary. And when I was in Baghdad and people would ask me to ask that question, I mean, I remember interviewing a family in a middle class neighborhood and I was asked to translate this question, and I couldn't ask the question personally because it was so crass. Why would it matter if they were Sunnis and Shia? But of course, within 6 months, a year, the Iraqis themselves accepted this binary definition. And because Saddam was a Sunni, by association, all the Sunnis were treated like, you know, if not criminal, then culprits in the atrocities of the regime, pushed into a corner. And that where the first sparks of a civil war emerge, not when people start fighting in the streets, but when people believe this idea of a binary division of a society.
Raith, not long after becoming a translator, by happenchance, you start taking photos and documenting what you were seeing. Tell us about this transition into journalism, and tell us about the first article you ever wrote.
So when I was an architect, I loved walking through the streets of Baghdad and taking pictures. And I call them kind of like a street photography of some sort, documenting the old neighborhoods of Baghdad. That quickly transitioned into walking through the streets of Baghdad and taking pictures of burned Humvees or, you know, kids firing mortars and shooting at each other. So that transition from framing and building into framing people was a very quick one. My first article came thanks to an American officer, because it was the day Saddam was captured, and I went to the hometown to, you know, ask the people what they thought. On the way back, we were stopped at the American checkpoint, and because we're two Iraqis, bearded, they thought we were suspicious while we were driving at night, so they put us in a jail cell, basically, a military army, Iraqi military jail cell. Next day, I realized the irony of it all, that I've dodged military service for 5 years to only end up in an Iraqi military jail, captured by my supposed liberators. And it was the, you know, the night when Saddam and I spent our first night in American jail. So that was the beginning. But
there are also beautiful pencil drawings scattered throughout your book. Another byproduct of your reporting?
That is when kind of my architectural self kind of reconciled with my journalist self, because after a while, my old fascination with streets and building came back, and I started doodling all these warscapes, basically the destruction in the city of Mosul, in other places like Aleppo and Yemen. And so I started filling my notebooks with these doodles. Plus, it's a very good way to procrastinate and not file your piece on time.
I'm talking to Raith Abdulahad. The world, the wider world, was horrified that the Americans had no plan for what would happen after the invasion. That must have astonished your fellow Iraqis.
That was the biggest shock for Iraqis, you know, because after all these years of sanctions, after all poverty and the need, they saw the Americans coming and they thought, okay, it's a Faustian deal. Let us at least get the Americans to rebuild the country, because that's America, right? I mean, like, they have these massive tanks with jet engines. So they thought within a couple of months, electricity would be back, you know, Baghdad will be turned into another Dubai. But what they saw is the utter chaos. The Americans had no idea. Worse, they were contributing to the chaos that was taking place. And of course, for many Iraqis, they couldn't believe that the Americans had no plan. I mean, how could they not have a plan? And they thought it's all a conspiracy targeting our great Iraqi nation and all that kind of stuff. And I think, not having a plan is one thing, but to stand there and watch the looting of military camps and all the weapons that was looted was used later against the Americans themselves and were taken to Syria, to as far as Yemen. All that criminal negligence, you know, it's not only you invade.
And the destruction of so many works of art as well. I remember being appalled by that.
15,000 pieces were kind of looted from the Iraqi Museum. The National Archives burned. This anger swept through the streets. And, you know, people were very angry against Saddam. And they thought by burning the building, by burning the archives, they can take their revenge against the regime. But by looting state institutions, they can exact their revenge against the regime. And that is, you know,
I can't resist reading this paragraph of yours. The occupation was bound to collapse and fail. Both logic and history tells us that. Because a nation can't be bombed, humiliated and sanctioned, then bombed again, and then told to become a democracy. No amount of planning could have turned an illegal occupation into a liberation.
Absolutely. You know, in the beginning, there was this narrative of if only the Americans would have done so and so, if only they didn't have disbanded the army. And that was the narrative. But later, you come to realize there was no way that this occupation could have succeeded. I mean, how could it? How could a foreign American invasion in the Middle East of all places succeed after almost a century of grievances and wars and atrocities?
No wonder you felt like a stranger in your own city.
I did. Within 2 years, the city where I grew up was a city that I couldn't travel through freely. I had to find people to vouch for me in different neighborhoods because it was a state of civil war. So you suddenly actually, as a person who'd never left the city for 28 years, you become a stranger.
We've talked about the stupidity of trying to make this binary Shia versus Sunni, when you write that it was far more complex than that, that there was a wide range of localized fracture lines and feuds.
Absolutely. Look, when you have a war, the kind of the dynamic of a civil war runs itself. I mean, it becomes very convenient to take over a house, to steal a car, to kidnap a person, claiming you're doing your religious duty. In reality, it was criminality on both sides, on all sides. And it's a constellation of local conflicts, regional conflict, local conflict. People who have grievances against the Americans. I mean, what the Americans did is they dismantle the security state in Iraq. And that allowed all the foreign jihadis to flock into the country to fight their war against the Americans. It also enabled the Iranians, who also were trying to, you know, had their own grievances against the Americans, to come and fight the Americans in Iraq rather than wait for the Americans to go to Iran. All these different factors were masqueraded or put under this grand title of a Sunni-Shia civil war.
So the invasion lends itself to the growth and spread of the jihadist groups and eventually to the rise of ISIS?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Saddam spent the 90s persecuting Sunni political religious movements, the Muslim Brotherhoods, the Salafis. Saddam was after them because they, you know, threatened his hold on power. And what do you have after 2003? You have not only kind of, you know, political Islam spreading, but you have religious extremists coming from as far as Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, flocking to Iraq because that became the battleground. So not only a civil war wouldn't have happened without the occupation, ISIS wouldn't have emerged a decade later without the American intervention in Iraq.
When I was introducing you, I mentioned the disputed death toll, but many think it was over a million, with certainly millions more displaced. The ongoing trauma of that must deeply and profoundly affect the people of Iraq.
Absolutely, because trauma doesn't disappear. I mean, when I was covering the Battle of Mosul and I saw how the Iraqi soldiers were torturing their detainees, because that is a legacy. It's a legacy of torture in the Iraqi state. It's a legacy of the torture of the Americans. It's the legacy now. The same thing with the trauma. The trauma, you know, doesn't disappear from a society. It just transforms itself from one form to another. And I think without accountability to those who perpetrated the war, who executed the war, who planned the war, foreigners and Iraqis, be it Bush or a local militia commander in the streets of Baghdad, without accountability, we cannot, you know, erase that trauma. Because up until today, 20 years on, no one has paid the price for this war, but the civilians, but the Iraqi people.
Iraq got a new prime minister in Nouri al-Maliki, I think in 2006. But you say democracy was another facade. What have been some of the problems with the post-2003 leadership and elites?
The ultimate problem is corruption. I mean, Iraq is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. It sits in the bottom of every single Transparency International index. I mean, it has a budget of $100-$120 billion a year, and yet parts of Baghdad, let alone parts of the south of the country, is on par with the worst, most impoverished countries in the world. And that's because of corruption. And because of this kind of social gap caused by the corruption, that is where the next, you know, social explosion will take place. That's where the people, so angry and frustrated with these elites living in the green zone, siphoning billions of dollars every year. And there was a spark of that potential conflict in 2019 when people went into the streets demanding a end of the corruption, massive demonstrations. It failed, but the anger is still there. And if you don't deal with the corruption, you will never have a peaceful country in Iraq.
The trauma will continue to affect young people who had no direct experience of the war, but it permeates the air they breathe.
The trauma is everywhere in Iraq at the moment. And the funny thing and the sad thing is democracy is another victim of that war. Because when people talk about democracy these days, they think of the parliament, which is, you know, kind of, it's one of these tools of corruption in Iraq. They think of the political parties who are all involved in this corruption. And they say, what? This is the democracy we want? No, maybe we need a strong leader. Maybe during the days of Saddam, life was better. And that is a disaster because you have a new generation associates democracy with corruption and then yearns for the strong man who could stop all of that. Again, another victim of the war.
Raith Abdulahad, it's been a privilege to talk to you. My guest is an award-winning Iraqi journalist for The Guardian, and we've been talking about his terrific book, A Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East's Long War, published by Penguin Random House.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.